want to introduce Rabbi Yitzhak Breidowitz. Sitting to my right, Rabbi Breidowitz wears two, I guess kippot I should say, not hats. Teaches, he's a rabbi at the Woodside Synagogue. For those of you who don't know, he also is a law professor at the University of Maryland. He got his smicha in Israel and his law degree from Harvard University Law School, and has spoken before us on several occasions. And today he's going to speak on a topic that is of interest to me and a lot of other people, and that is the Beit Din process. And I'll just introduce it by saying, if you don't know anything about it, disputes between and among Jews traditionally, the traditional view is, should not be brought into a civilian court. It should be settled amongst ourselves, so to speak, and a process called the Beit Din process. And the rabbi will let us know what that's all about today.
Right, yeah, that's exactly what I was going to begin with. You know, that over the past 25 or 30 years, there's been a lot of emphasis in the American system on getting disputes out of courts and having alternative dispute resolution, whether it be called arbitration, mediation, mini-trials, or various other combinations. And the truth is, it might be a fruitful time to push a very long and ancient institution whose time perhaps has, I wouldn't say has come, but has re-come, and that is the Beis Din, the Jewish forum for the resolution of disputes. As was just indicated, under classical halakha, it is actually prohibited for one Jew to take another Jew to court unless that other Jew has refused to submit to a Beit Din, or it's apparent under the circumstances that it would be a useless gesture to do so. And halakha very much encourages and indeed demands that disputes between a Jew and a Jew should be resolved in a Beit Din. Of course, this does not apply in a Jew versus non-Jew. The Beit Din system is mandatory only for Jew versus Jew. Now, what is a Beit Din? Beit Din literally means a house of judgment or a house of justice. And there are two different ways a Beit Din can be constituted. The optimal way, which is not the way that we typically have it in the United States, is that every community would have an officially designated rabbinical court that would resolve disputes that Jews have against Jews, whether it be based on contract torts. Sometimes we forget that Jewish substantive law has a very rich tradition of matters that in modern society we might regard as largely secular. There's a whole part of the Shulchan Aruch that deals with contracts and torts and property. And sometimes the principles are similar to American law, sometimes they are different. But there is. Judaism is not merely concerned with the ritual, but it certainly embraces what we would call civil disputes. Now, optimally, every community should have an officially designated rabbinical court of three judges. That is the normal composition of a Beit Din, three judges. Most communities, including Washington, cannot afford to have a judiciary on the payroll of the Jewish community. And as a result, what we have is basically an ad hoc system, which is already been described in Talmudic times, in which when parties want to take their dispute to a Beit Din, each litigant chooses a rabbi of their choice, and the two rabbis then choose a third. And therefore, that is what we call an ad hoc Beit Din, which can be recomposed as every single case arises. The Hebrew acronym for this system is Zabla, which in English you could spell Z-A-B-L-A, which simply stands for the Mishnaic phrase Ze Borer Lo Echad. Each one chooses one, and in the middle, the two rabbis then choose a third. If, for example, in Washington, you wanted to take another Jew to Beit Din, there is no official Beit Din, so to speak, but basically you would initiate the process through a Zabla, meaning you would contact a rabbi that you trust, and you would ask the rabbi to send kind of a summons to the other party, but it's not really a summons because there is no court yet, there is no Beit Din yet, but it is a summons indicating that a process has been initiated, and the summons might say, please designate your rabbi within 30 days. Now, what happens if the person just says, forget it, I'm not going to bother, which, of course, because again, there's nothing compelling the person to do so. Well, under halakha, what happens is the following. If a person refuses to either submit to a Beit Din, an existing Beit Din, or a person refuses to participate in creating a Beit Din, So that person is called in Hebrew a misarei. Misarei means a person in contempt. Again, there's no court that can hold him in contempt, but practically what that means is the halachic ban against access to the civil courts can now be lifted, meaning to say that halacha requires utilization of the Beit Din only if there is some chance the procedure is going to work. When it's apparent that the other party is not interested in starting the process, the plaintiff who is willing to initiate the Beit Din process will be given authorization by a rabbi or by another Beit Din, depending on how it's constituted, to be able to file suits in secular courts or whatever the case may be. So that's really the practical consequence of a person not cooperating. The person doesn't go to jail for contempt of court, but the person is deemed a misarev, and at that point one is given permission to go to the secular courts. Now, the truth of the matter is, there are some problems in the Zabla. As I say, problem number one, and I'll talk about Zabla because that is the norm in the United States. Israel is a little different. In Israel, you may know, the rabbinical courts are actually part of the official judiciary of the land. Now, their jurisdiction is limited. Their jurisdiction is limited by secular law to matters involving marriage and divorce and family status. Now, Israel is a very, very complicated situation because at least in the United States we have a concept of separation of church and state. In Israel, notwithstanding the fact that so much of the population is not observant, there is a very, very strong mixture of church and state, and that is the religious courts are part of the secular judiciary, but they also function as religious courts, meaning any religious rabbinical judge, I should say, in the land of Israel, owes their primary allegiance not to the laws of the Knesset, but to the laws of the Torah. Now, what is very strange is that the decisions of the rabbinical courts are reviewable by the Supreme Court of Israel. So you will have a rabbinical judge that decides halakha should be X, Y, and Z, and the Supreme Court of Israel, many of whose members are not religious at all and not committed to halakha, will say, we believe you misconstrued halakhic sources and we reverse your decision. Now, what's complicated is, although an American lawyer is used to the fact that if the Supreme Court of the United States reverses the Court of Appeals, you know, that's the law, a rabbinical judge in Israel is not going to defer to a halachic determination of the Supreme Court of Israel because that's a non-halachic court. So you have the ironic situation of judges which legally are subordinate to other bodies who typically go their own way. And indeed, I would have to endorse that approach, because if they are applying what they regard to be the law of God, they cannot necessarily allow a secular judge to overrule them. This has come up a lot, just to give you one example, regarding women's rights. Again, I'm not going to get into a whole debate, but as you know, halakha does impose what some might regard as certain disabilities on women, particularly regarding inheritance rights. So typically, if an inheritance matter goes in front of a Beit Din, the Beit Din will apply the law of the Torah that says when there are sons and daughters, the sons inherit the property, but the daughters have a lien for support rights until they get married. So it isn't as bad as people think. They have the status of a creditor, a first priority creditor, to be paid out of the estate in the manner to which they are accustomed. Now, as you know, the state of Israel, as a Western democracy, has passed essentially an equal rights amendment that provides that men and women have equal inheritance rights. And yet, jurisdiction over inheritance laws is still vested in the rabbinical courts. Now, the rabbinical courts don't follow that secular law because that is not the law of the Torah. So again, that's a whole talk for another time, the extremely complicated, multifaceted institution of the rabbinical court in Israel, which on one hand is a freestanding rabbinical court, and at the other hand is part of a secular judiciary. But in the United States, because we do have separation of church and state, we don't have that particular problem, but we have other problems. And that is, if we assume that a typical Beit Din is the Zabla variety, meaning I choose a rabbi, you choose a rabbi, and the two rabbis choose a third. So obviously you can see problem number one is very often the process never gets off the ground. I want to take you to a Beit Din. I say, my rabbi is so-and-so, pick yours. You may just say, forget it. And then the Beit Din is finished and we simply go to secular court. But let's assume a best case scenario where I got mine, you got yours, and the two agreed on a third. And by the way, let me just add as an aside, it is not easy to get rabbis to want to sit on a Beit Din. You know, I remember a time when I used to be trying to get rabbis to be on Beit Dins, and they would always tell me no, and I was wondering, you know, what type of business is that? What? How could a rabbi turn down such a responsibility to the Jewish community? Now that I'm in the position of being asked to be on a Beit Din, and after having been on a number of them, I fully understand what their reluctance was. It's extremely time-consuming, and particularly when you deal with domestic relations matters, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, basically it's very, very difficult to have any type of closure or satisfactory resolution. But let's assume we have the optimal situation where I have my rabbi, you have your rabbi, the two have agreed. But what then happens? Well, there'll be correspondence in which a date will be designated to show up. The parties will show up. Now, the very first thing that will occur at the sitting of a Beit Din is, ironically, not a religious ceremony, but a secular ceremony. The parties will be asked to sign an arbitration agreement, which in effect designates the rabbinical judges as arbitrators, and there's an agreement to submit the dispute to arbitration. Of course, the dispute would have to be defined with some specificity and clarity, as is true for any submission to arbitration. And the reason why this is such an essential part of the process is because since a Beit Din in America has no enforcement power, unlike a rabbinical court in Israel, which is part of the legal system, so if the Beit Din would not have the parties sign an arbitration agreement, they could issue a decision. And if the other party simply says, well, so what? I don't like it. What's going to happen? The whole procedure then becomes a nullity. So the purpose of the arbitration agreement is to ensure that, as is true for any arbitration award, the matter can then be confirmed in court, and at that point the secular judiciary could be used to enforce the decision of the Beit Din. That's very significant, and the courts have uniformly taken the position, quite sensibly, that having a secular court enforce the decision of a Beit Din pursuant to an arbitration agreement is not a violation of the separation of church and state, because it is a neutral principle. I mean, if the arbitration agreement designated Mo, Larry, and Curly to be the arbitrators, the court would enforce it in the absence of fraud. So the fact that it's a religious institution does not involve any particular entanglement with religion per se, and therefore it's been quite successful both in Maryland and particularly in New York, as you would expect. There's a rich precedent of the New York Court of Appeals affirming the confirmation of an arbitral award pursuant to a Beit Din decision. So that's the very first thing that the parties will be asked to do, to number one, define the issues, and that may take some discussion, and number two, execute an arbitration agreement. And now there are standardized forms which most Beit Dins get today, even the ad hoc Beit Din, because again, even though it's a Zavla, but the same coterie of rabbis tend to always be chosen because they gain a certain reputation, and therefore someone that does this a lot will tend to have these standardized forms. Now,
are they baked?
Okay, now this depends. This depends. There is absolutely no standardized practice. I've been on many Beit Dins, and I normally do not get paid. I'm aware of other rabbis that do get paid. Still, however, the going rate is much cheaper than litigation, and it's much cheaper than commercial arbitration. A typical Beit Din at its highest, and we're talking about three rabbis, will charge in the range of $150 a day. And that could include, 6 hours of sitting. So it's really not, even when you're paying, it's not really a problem. I mean, you're defraying costs. There are costs involved too, in terms of the rabbi's time, in terms of duplication, in terms of secretarial assistance. So it basically covers the cost of the proceeding. Now, the concept of having the parties execute an arbitration agreement is so fundamental that a Beit Din will normally not proceed. Sometimes you'll have some guy that'll say, well, I'm here to go to the Beit Din as a religious matter and a moral matter. I am not interested in making this legal. After all, is not the whole purpose of this proceeding not to go to court? Well, the Beit Din will normally tell the person, either sign or we will dismiss the case right now. Now, the person might be quite happy to have the case dismissed, but again, as I indicated before, if the person has refused to go ahead with the Beit Din procedure, the plaintiff will be given authorization to seek recourse in secular court. So that's kind of the club that pushes the person to go in. Now, what types of matters can be submitted to a Beit Din? Commercial matters, very, very definitely. Real estate matters, commercial matters. And here I want to mention an interesting little point that's somewhat subtle. And that is, I think we have to, you know, as lawyers, we're all very, very familiar with the distinction between procedural law and substantive law. And it's very interesting that even though halakha requires that parties go to, you know, two Jews resolve their dispute by going to a Beit Din as a matter of procedure, that does not automatically mean that the applicable rule of decision will be halakha. And the reason that is so is because halakha itself incorporates in many civil disputes a concept that is called dina de malchuta dina, which means the law of the land is the law. Meaning to say that obviously does not apply in religious matters. I mean, but in many matters dealing with property, in matters dealing with contract, just as a secular court would construe a contract based on course of dealing, course of performance, customary practice, halakha recognizes minhag as well. So the interesting paradox is that when you have your three rabbis who are sitting as a Beit Din, they may be looking at, you know, Maryland Annotated Code and Supreme Court decisions and Maryland Court of Appeal, and they'll have to have some attorney who will give them access to those materials. Because the fact that the case goes to the Beit Din does not inescapably mean that it's going to be resolved by reference to classical Jewish law, because Jewish law itself brings in the concept of minhag, of customary practice and the like. So in a commercial dispute, the Beit Din has been very, very successful. Number one, it tends to be money. It doesn't have the animosities that you'd expect in domestic relations law. And number two, commercial disputes are very amenable to arbitration, and the courts have very little difficulty in confirming commercial awards, unless there's fraud or, you know, whatever the basis would be to set aside a secular arbitration. A court could set aside a Beit Din arbitration as well. Now let me just stick on the commercial situation for a moment, just so you get the picture. Now, do attorneys show up? Once again, the practice varies from Beit Din to Beit Din. In classical Jewish practice, as set out in the Talmud, attorneys were not a very favored class of people. It says in Ethics of the Fathers, and again, I have a declaration against my interest as well, so I don't feel I'm offending you too much, but Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, makes the statement, do not make yourself like an attorney, like an advocate. And the concept was that the Talmud was very suspicious, as many are even today, of the advocate who twists and distorts, even if there's not an outright lie. But obviously, you shade, only you emphasize those parts of the case that are favorable to you.
O.J. Simpson.
Well, yeah, we had a very good example before Yom Kippur this year. And the theory of the adversary system, of course, is, well, I distort my case, you distort your case, and therefore everybody's pulling, and therefore you see the truth. But of course, in the real world, lawyers are not fungible quantities. Therefore, one person can twist it more than the other person, and therefore the truth doesn't always emerge. And therefore, in the classical Beit Din system, was much more similar to the inquisitorial method that is employed in continental Europe, where the judges, take a very, very activist role in questioning and in obtaining evidence and in examining evidence and the like. Some rabbis, and again, that's the Zavla is a very relaxed procedure because you don't have fixed rules. Some rabbis refuse to allow attorneys in there. However, in my observation, that is decidedly a minority. Because particularly when you're dealing with commercial disputes, which the resolution itself depends on secular law, if nothing else, you need an attorney to function as an advisor to the Beit Din. And therefore, what you typically see, 9 out of 10 times in a Beit Din, and certainly this is true in Washington and in Baltimore, there will be attorneys present if the parties so desire. They don't have to have them. But it is still a hybrid, meaning to say, the attorneys are present, but the cross-examination tends to be conducted by the court. In other words, the judges ask the questions, the judges elicit the answers. If the attorneys feel certain facts were not brought out, The attorneys can talk. They can counsel their clients. They can supply the courts or the judges with whatever legal data or information they need to get. And of course, all papers are served on all parties, as you would expect, under basic fairness. So if somebody is going to give me a lot of Supreme Court cases that are relevant to the issue, they have to be provided to the other party as well. So the modern baked-in procedure tends to be a hybrid between the adversarial system and the inquisitorial system, meaning it is inquisitorial because judges do conduct the bulk of the questioning directly with the witnesses and the parties. However, attorneys are present, and attorneys do have a right to say whatever they want to say in order to inform the baked-in, etc. Now, the rules of evidence are very much relaxed. And in a sense, this is true with arbitration, you know, as every arbitration as well. Hearsay is certainly admissible. Obviously, credibility can be raised. In other words, if something is hearsay or something seems to be not as material, that goes to credibility, but it tends not to go to admissibility. Now, this is a very interesting little point, because if you're familiar with Talmudic law, you might say, well, gee, this is kind of exactly the opposite of the Talmud, because the Talmudic law of evidence is absolutely distinguished with an extreme rigidity of exclusionary rules. For example, under Talmudic law, women were not kosher to testify, non-Jews were not kosher to testify, children below bar mitzvah were not kosher to testify, because that tends not to come up a lot anyway, except in domestic relations. Documentary evidence was inadmissible because of something similar to a hearsay rule, although it wasn't called hearsay per se. Even Jewish people who were not Shomer Shabbat are not kosher to testify. So, where do we go from here to there? I mean, on one hand, we have a Talmudic system of evidence, which is extremely rigid and strict, and yet, what I'm telling you is that in a modern baked in, everything comes in. Well, the answer is that since conducting a baked-in procedure in accordance with the halakhic rules of evidence would make resolution of a dispute virtually impossible, as part of the arbitration submission, I forgot to mention this before, the parties sign a clause waiving their right to object to the admissibility of evidence on grounds of exclusionary rules. So that is a built-in clause. If you see the standard, the Hebrew term is shtar beruin, that just means document of submission. But you see, there are certain things you've got to put in that wouldn't be in a pure arbitration submission, such as a waiver of rules of evidence. Because you understand, otherwise, if you have to prove your case by getting a Shomer Shabbos, and I should also add, non-related, relatives are not kosher either. So you have to prove your case by a non-related Shomer Shabbos Jewish male, you know, above the age of 13, that would make things very, very difficult. And therefore, the Beit Din will normally demand, as a condition of going further, that there be a waiver. And therefore, as a result, if we get to the bottom line, women come in, hearsay comes in, documents come in, attorneys have rights to come in. Now, this is an important point, because many, many attorneys steer their clients away from the Beit Din because it is an unfamiliar form. And, you know, that's a problem. It's unfamiliar in terms of procedure. And even more scary, it might be unfamiliar in terms of substantive law, if the substantive law that will be applied will be halakha. And this is something that needs to be talked about, however, with a rabbi or the like, because very, very often, as I say, the substantive law will in fact be the second law, be the same law an arbitrator would apply, even though it goes to the Beit Din. Now, there are other things you could be afraid of. You could be afraid of competence of the rabbis. Now, that's a very touchy issue. But obviously, when you're dealing with complicated commercial matters, you have to have people who understand what's going on. And not everybody is equally competent in these matters. And you know, that's something to be sensitive to. Now,
of halakha?
All matters pertaining to child custody, to division of property, to visitation and support. As a religious matter, between husband and wife, a Jewish husband and a Jewish wife, should be adjudicated by a Beit Din. Now, this creates certain problems, however, because even if the parties finally have their Beit Din, and they go to their Beit Din, as you know, you cannot really concretize a finality to these decisions by an arbitration agreement, because certainly any agreement to arbitrate disputes pertaining to custody, visitation, and in some jurisdictions even child support, is subject to the court's de novo review on the grounds that it's the parents' patria, and therefore it reviews the agreements in light of the best interest of the children. Meaning to say that unlike a commercial dispute where a Beit Din's decision, if there's an arbitration submission, is essentially going to be final in the absence of fraud, a decision regarding child custody or visitation is not going to have any presumptive finality. Now here, though, it really depends. I'll give you an example of something that happened in Maryland that I'm familiar with. A Beit Din issued a very well-reasoned decision regarding child custody in a very bitter divorce. And the trial judge, the circuit court in Baltimore City, said, kind of rubber stamped it, he said, this is great. Now, of course, he got reversed by the Court of Special Appeals, because the Court of Special Appeals said, you're not supposed to rubber stamp things. You have to exercise your independent judgments in determining the best interest of the kids. However, this judge liked the baseless decision anyway, so all he did was he just incorporated verbatim, word for word, of the base of the decision, and said, this is my independent judgment. And that, of course, was affirmed. So the truth of the matter is, you know, as any lawyer knows, these rules can be manipulated. In other words, if the judge likes what the base then did, it will say, I have exercised my independent judgment, and this is it. If it doesn't like it, it'll reverse it, or even if it rubber stamps it, it'll get reversed anyway. So, but there is a point that the finality is not the same. But let me emphasize that that is only a secular concern. That is not a religious concern. Meaning to say, if a Beit Din, let's assume, has awarded primary custody to a parent, there is a religious duty on the other parent not to contest that. But in the real world, you know, when it comes to your kids, people don't listen to what a Beit Din does, and they freely go to court, and they try to relitigate. But I want to emphasize that the lack of finality from a secular perspective has no relevance in terms of what the religious imperative is. So one problem with the child custody issues is the lack of finality and the fact that the dissatisfied parent commonly ignores the decision of the Beit Din, and there's very little the Beit Din can do if the secular courts are willing to have a de novo review. A second issue, of course, is the very bitter and divisive nature of these disputes themselves, in which children are at stake, and you know, there's a lot of tragedy. The truth is, I don't know if the Beit Din is worse than any other forum. Basically, this is an endemic problem to this whole type of procedure. A second aspect of this is the issue of women who need to get a religious divorce, a get. And they don't get one, right? This is the problem of the aguna. I think I've got a book on the subject, or what can be done. And you know, New York has some two very interesting laws. New York, under New York state law, a person who files a complaint for a civil divorce, a civil dissolution, must file a verified affidavit under oath that they have removed any barriers to the remarriage of the other spouse. Matt Moon was the drafter of this bill, of this law, back in 1983, and the theory being, therefore, that a husband could not get a civil divorce unless he files under oath that he has given his wife a get. That's what it boils down to. And obviously, this barrier to remarriage stuff was there to avoid a direct reference to get, which would have raised constitutional issues. And so that's the New York law in 1983. However, that's of limited effectiveness, because that's only going to help the woman if the husband files a complaint for civil divorce. If he's willing to commit adultery or whatever it is, or wait till his wife wants a civil divorce, there's no remedy for her. But in 1992, New York passed an additional law that says that in determining equitable distribution of marital assets, there's a whole potpourri of factors the court considers, and one of them is whether or not there is a barrier to the remarriage of the other spouse. Meaning, effectively, a judge in the state of New York, and this is only true in New York today, can tell a husband, if you give your wife a get, you get 50% of the marital home, and if you don't, you get nothing. Now, this is a pretty strong sanction, because this punishes a person in the pocketbook. And this basically means that the judge has equitable authority to terminate marital property interests unless they get his forthcoming. And in fact, it's also a factor in the determination of support and maintenance, in other words, the alimony award. The court can say that for every week you don't give a get, you're going to pay $500 a week alimony, and we'll cut it down to $250 or under. So that's powerful. That was a newer addition, and that could actually work quite well. Interestingly enough, the key objection to the New York statute is halachic concerns, because halacha does invalidate certain gittin that are obtained by secular coercion, because they are not a product of free will. So ironically, many great rabbis in Israel have been saying, we have to get rid of this second New York law. See, the first New York law is not considered duress, because the first law simply tells the husband, you know, it's a denial of a benefit, it's a denial of a carrot. We're not going to give you a civil divorce, we're going to leave you in your status quo. So that's not coercive. But the second law, which basically says, if you don't give a get, we're taking away the house, that is penal, that is punitive, intentionally so, and perhaps rightfully so. But nevertheless, ironically, the more of a stick you make it, the more it shades into halakhic problems. So that's a talk for another time, but be it as it may, that's New York. Maryland doesn't have anything like that at all. Maryland, D.C., I mean, no other state of the Union has any type of way that a court could directly put pressure on a guy to give a get. So what happens? A woman takes a man to Beit Din, and the woman says, the man abused me, the man is unfaithful to me. In other words, whatever the halakhic grounds, according to Maimonides, even if she just says, he's repulsive to me. In other words, according to Maimonides, irreconcilable differences is a basis. So let's assume the woman gets her order, and the Beit Din solemnly tells the man, thou shalt give a get. Let's assume she gets her order. The question then becomes, what happens at that point? Meaning to say, you know, what did Andrew Jackson say? I believe, Andrew Jackson said, the Supreme Court has issued its decision, let him send the army to enforce it. And I think Mussolini said the same thing about the Pope. How many soldiers did the Pope have in his army? And the truth of the matter is, the Beit Din, even if a woman gets an order of a Beit Din, and it's not that easy to get either, if she gets the order, what's going to happen? The arbitration agreement isn't going to work, because first of all, in this type of case, the husband would not have signed an arbitration agreement. And second of all, an arbitration agreement to agree to give a get would not generally, might not be confirmed. And that's a serious problem, because... Well, what you could do is, you could put a clause in the ketubah to submit to arbitration and abide by the decision, and then if the Beit Din orders a get, that might be a possible way. Yes, the arbitration route might be a possible way. In many of these cases, there was no prenuptial agreement. That's why people are talking about having a prenuptial agreement here. Without that prenuptial arbitration agreement, which will cover the get, we have a problem of the unenforceable order. That's really the problem. And what happens today? So it's a difficult situation. New York, as I say, has given some relief. But no other legislature has gone that far. And basically what a Beit Din has at its disposal is community pressure and opprobrium, which might be significant and it might be zero. It tends to be more on the zero side than the... community opprobrium means they can declare that the man is excommunicated, he's not entitled to synagogue honors, his membership in a shul will be terminated, he cannot have a bar mitzvah, he cannot have his kids have a bar mitzvah or something like that. But you see, in our multicultural Jewish society, even in the Orthodox camp, there are so many synagogues. You go to Baltimore, right? There are 20 synagogues within a radius of a mile. So if synagogue A takes a stand kicking the guy out, the guy will go to synagogue B. So there will be husband synagogues and wife synagogues. This synagogue sides with husband, this synagogue sides with wife. Certainly in a city like New York, you're going to have that. So the notion of posting and community pressure tends to be much less effective than perhaps it ought to be, particularly since there's a lot of backsniping amongst Beis-Din. In other words, Beis-Din A issues an order. Unfortunately, we don't have a full faith and credit clause. Well, actually, we do. We do have a full faith and credit clause, but it's not enforced and it's commonly ignored. And very often, if people don't like what a Beis-Din does, they'll go convene some other Beis-Din, which will issue some other decision. I've received myself things in the mail asking me to state why I think a Beis-Din's decision was wrong. And my position is, I will not even look at it. I say that in order for a system to have a certain amount of integrity, there has to be a tolerance for wrong decisions. Again, perhaps you may not agree with me, but sometimes it is more important that there be finality and closure than every last thing be correct. And this is certainly the principle of appellate review, in which you don't necessarily review every factual determination. And if people are to respect a Beis-Din system, there has to be a sense that when they decide, unless there's fraud or corruption, I'm not talking about that, I'm just talking about on the merits, their judgments, you know, one group of rabbis could come to one conclusion, one group of rabbis could come to another. It is important, I think, to the integrity of the system that there not be that type of second-guessing and sniping, because there is no formalized appellate provision here. All Beis-Dins are the same. So I have no particular authority to look at somebody else's decision. So the community pressure has been not as strong as it should have been. I understand that in Lincoln Square Synagogue, which is a large modern Orthodox synagogue in Manhattan, they are very, very intense on putting the pressure on people. If a husband or a wife has refused to obey the decision that they did, they will terminate membership and they will not allow the person to be called to the Torah. And I would hope that that would be a model that other communities would follow. I'll just end with one little story, though. One type of pressure was very, very effective. The New York Times reported this around 5 years ago about a man who refused to give a get to his wife. So all of the Orthodox women in the town refused to go to the mikveh until and we are told because they know the ritual back.
It's a retelling of Mrs. Strachan.
That's right. That's right. So the get was signed, sealed, and delivered within two or three days. So, right. So those things can work.
Fine.
But these are problems that we have. But I would urge people to look into the notion of a Beis-Din as a cheap, relatively expeditious way of solving disputes, and it is really very, very successful in the commercial area. Again, some Beis-Dins have even handled multi-million-dollar cases, but I've been on Beis-Dins which did involve, you know, $500,000. And we had 2 days of hearings, and you know, we came to some type of resolution, and it seemed to have worked out well. So it is something to consider when advising your clients. In fact, I don't want to overburden you with halakhic technicalities. There is even a question whether you are allowed to assist a Jew in bringing a lawsuit against a fellow Jew, since you are facilitating the commission of a religious transgression. If he's not allowed to take his fellow Jew to secular court, you may not be allowed to represent him. So it even goes that far in terms of being an aider and abettor to a halachic transgression.
You kept referring to, I think correctly, in current practice, to rabbis being the members of a Beis Din, but yeah, if you look, as I recall, in practice of Sanhedrin, I don't think it's required that every member has to have a smicha.
That's correct. So rabbinical ordination is not a requirement to be on a Beis Din. There should be one person, at least, who is a rabbi. The other two members can be lay people, but they should have a general familiarity with Jewish law. In fact, a member of my synagogue, he happens to be ordained, but He runs a Jewish arbitration and mediation service, which is essentially a Beit Din, but without the aura of rabbinical authority. They don't advertise them. I mean, he happens to be rabbis, but they don't advertise them as rabbis. They're experienced attorneys and mediators who try to resolve disputes in the spirit of equity and compromise. In fact, I should emphasize this other point. When you go to a Beit Din, Beit Din will give the litigants a choice. They will ask the litigants, do you want us to decide this according to halakha, what the law says, or do you want us to decide this according to principles of Peshara, which means equity, compromise, discretionary fairness? And contrary to what you think, the Beit Din will push for the second choice. So effectively, what a Beit Din will seek, and sometimes they'll be so insistent they will not even hear the case based on strict law. They will insist that they be given the discretion to be able to resolve this based on prevailing notions of fairness and reasonableness.
So why is the question asked?
Well, sometimes the question is not asked. Sometimes on the document it'll say the parties waive their rights to evidence, as we said, and they waive their rights to have strict halakha applied, and they agree to allow prevailing fairness, customary practice to be applied.
Did the Supreme Court in Israel declare a law of the Knesset invalid because it conflicts with halakha?
No, they cannot. They cannot, except within those areas where the law of the Knesset delegates finality to halakha. So, for example, in the area of marriage and divorce, you know, there is no civil divorce or marriage. So Israel will recognize a civil marriage or divorce that was obtained abroad. Mm-hmm. That's why people go to Cyprus to get married. But there is no institution of civil, this is true for Arabs too, there is no institution of civil marriage within the state of Israel. Now the Knesset, however, could pass a law changing that. In fact, that's a proposal. And if they do so, they could change that as well. But halakha, this is a kind of a strange bedfellow issue. Halakha right now is not regarded as authoritative in the secular law of Israel, but in a recent amendment, around 5 years old, it was provided that in the event of a lacuna, if there is a gap, so the old law provided Israel should look at the principles of common law and Ottoman law to fill the gap, and now the requirement is if there's a gap, they are to look to halakha to fill the gap. So that's a lacuna. Now, it's interesting that there's a very strange coalition who are against this. The ultra-secularists are very much against the use of halakha in a secular state, because that's their position. And the ultra-rights, the ultra-orthodox, if you use that term, are also against it, because they feel that when halakha is being applied by a secular judiciary, the integrity of halakha itself is being distorted, and it's better to keep it two different worlds. You have the halakhic system, you have the secular system, let the secular people do what they want, we don't listen to them anyway, and we'll do what we want. So it's interesting that the strange coalition is you have people who are totally removed from religion and people who are totally preoccupied with religion, and both of them are against this kind of integration that's going on. Then you have people in the middle. You know, a Hasidic Rebbe once said, now one day we talk about walking in the middle, but when you walk in the middle of the road, you get hit by cars going in both directions. So Menachem Alon, who was on the Israeli Supreme Court, he recently retired, is a person whose whole life has been devoted towards getting the legal system of Israel to be more responsive to authentic Jewish tradition. He brings in halakha whenever he can in all of his opinions. As a Supreme Court justice, he tries to justify it based on halakha. But Menachem Alon gets flack from the left and from the right because of what he was trying to do.
You said that you do bring in local law when you're on a European, if you were on the West Bank and the dispute was over land, you bring in Jordanian law?
That is definitely a possibility. But it's a little tricky because the basis of bringing in foreign law would not be because the foreign law is in itself authoritative, but it furnishes the backdrop to establish the probable expectations of the parties. In other words, when we enter into a contract, in fact, John Marshall made the point, we enter into a contract against the backdrop of certain expectations, and the law can be a source of what those expectations are. So it's not a de jure legitimacy of foreign law, but it's a de facto incorporation based on the probable intention of the parties, so it's a little different. But certainly, if Jordanian law could have furnished the expectation, then indeed that could come in as well.
We'll take one more question. I'm sorry, just one more question, because I know some people might have.
Yeah, I'm sorry to keep
that. Who is actually using what they did? Is it mostly Orthodox? Is it?
Okay.
And what's like? What? Yeah. How many cases go to the Beit Din each year?
Okay. Yeah, it depends on the community. I would have to say that the vast bulk of people who use the Beit Din are Orthodox. Both sides are Orthodox. Occasionally, committed conservative Jews will use the Beit Din. And of course, the Jewish Theological Seminary does have a conservative Beit Din. So there are Beit Dins that are organized under the auspices of the conservative movement, although they're not as widely used as the Orthodox Beit Dins are. The Reform movement itself has not gone with the Beit Din procedure. Now, theoretically, if all the parties are in agreement, the Beit Din will even hear a case involving a Jew and a non-Jew, and that has happened. But that, of course, requires mutual consent, and it's rare because the non-Jew doesn't feel necessarily they'll get a good shake of the Beit Din, although there's no reason why they wouldn't. There's no particular discrimination in the law. How many cases? It depends. In both, I'll give you an example. In Silver Spring or Washington, Greater Washington, we get probably 4 cases a year. Very little. In Baltimore, which has a much larger Orthodox community, they probably get 4 or 5 cases a week. I know because I'm always getting calls to, you know, be specially assigned there. You know, so it all depends. In a place like New York, there'll be a lot more. So the more Jews, the more litigation. The more Orthodox Jews, the more basements. So
there'd be more Miami.
There is a lot of Miami. In fact, one instance in which there's a lot of, if you ever want to do research in Lexis or Westlaw on secular cases dealing with Beit Dins, the most fertile area that has been litigated involves rabbis whose contracts have been terminated or not renewed. And usually, in these rabbinical contracts, it does say, disputes shall be resolved by the Beit Din. And usually, if the Beit Din decides one way or the other side isn't happy with whatever came out, and they go to court and challenge it. And New York must have 20 or 25 cases dealing with this. Just you read the stories, and it's amazing what people do after their contracts are terminated. I'm just frankly astounded. I mean, there have been rabbis who have refused to leave. They continue. They already hired a new guy, and they get up and they give the sermon every week. You know, I mean, just, so these things do go on.
There seems to be somewhat of a contradiction in all of this. I mean, you have this arbitration agreement, and I mean, if the Beit Din is supposed to be, you know, observant and everything else, and you already, from the beginning, right away, remove all of the, you know, Shomer Shabbos. I mean, I understand the practicality of that, but I mean, I'm just confused because who's to judge at what point you start looking at those sorts of limitations and that those are okay to remove but that other sorts of things aren't okay?
Well, the answer is, again, any waiver of halachic requirements must find its authority within the corpus of halacha. Meaning, you don't waive halacha. A halachic court cannot waive halacha except where within the system there is provision for waiver. And in halacha, generally speaking, the parties are given a tremendous amount of latitude to stipulate in advance what the rules of evidence will be. So it's a waiver within the halakhic system as opposed to a waiver outside the halakhic system. So that itself gives it a religious legitimacy, not merely a secular one.
Right. Rabbi, I want to thank you for